Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
Tonight on The Readout.
I'd love to talk to you people. I'd love to say everything that's on my mind, but I'm restricted because I have a gag order. And I'm not sure that anybody's ever seen anything like this before.
Day two of testimony in Trump's hush money election interference trial. And the judge has already had it with Trump and his legal team. Meanwhile, I was in the courtroom as the first witness, David Pecker, gave riveting testimony about his interactions with Trump. I will tell you what I saw and heard. And that is where we begin tonight, with the historic first ever trial of a former American president, as Donald Trump spent a second day in court before a Manhattan jury. It was a day that I can say I witnessed personally as I took my turn to be at the courthouse. And has been the case so far, there were no throngs of Trump supporters outside raising hell on his behalf. I only noticed this one guy who had a crucifix and rang a loud bell while wearing a T-shirt declaring that the three greatest U.S. presidents were George Washington, John F. Kennedy, and Donald Trump. Other than that, for all the giant barricades erected downtown, the largest numbers present were police officers and reporters, plus a couple of adorable middle schoolers who came down to see the events from inside court. Inside the courthouse, I started out as Team Overflow Room, and then, through the endless grace of Lisa Rubin, moved to the main courtroom for the second half of the day. And while I've written a book about Donald Trump called The Man Who Sold America, for which I interviewed many a Trump person and former campaign staffers, etc., today was the first time I've actually been in the same room with Donald Trump, the tormentor of black teenagers like myself in the late 1980s when the Central Park Five trial took place in that very same courthouse. What I can tell you is that he is taller than you might expect and walks in a gait that is shufflier than you'd think, kind of a shuffly waddle. And he's definitely a scowler, although who wouldn't be scowly facing 34 criminal counts in a case that could, in theory, send you to prison? I can also confirm that he has a strangely orange hue, although lighter orange now that he's out of the Florida sun and away from the tanning beds. And whoever does his hair masks the thinning in the back and on top with some deft cantilevering. But how today started was not so much about Donald Trump, the man, as it was about Donald Trump, the obsessive, repeated social media user. The first 2 hours of the day, without the jury present, was a battle between Trump's lead defense attorney, Todd Blanche, and Judge Juan Marchand about whether Trump had, on 10 separate occasions, violated an April 1st gag order by posting and reposting about potential witnesses in this case, including Michael Cohen, Stormy Daniels, and even former New York prosecutor Mark Pomerantz, who apparently Donald Trump wants to see jailed. The posts included amplifying comments from Michael Avenatti, who you might remember represented Stormy Daniels before she fired him for apparently stealing from her and other clients, something for which he remains in prison, though he somehow is also still doing interviews. And also for amplifying this segment on Fox, attacking the jurors in this case on April 17th.
They are trying to rig this jury. They are catching undercover liberal activists lying to the judge.
Yeah, no, they're not. Judge Marchand proceeded to scold Todd Blanche in extended fashion for not being able to explain to him how Trump's attacks were a response to political attacks. It was kind of like watching the kid who didn't do his homework get owned by the college professor. And when it was over, Todd Blanche was quickly moved to second chair. When that part of the hearing ended, it was on to business, part two of the questioning of David Pecker. Pecker, who owned American Media, Inc. during the 1990s and early aughts, is a smooth-talking, silver-haired man with a comely mustache who seems to have almost idolized Donald Trump. He described him as someone Americans respected as the boss on The Apprentice, which was also the way Michael Cohen referred to Trump. Pecker said the Trump covers were consistently the National Enquirer's bestsellers. The other covers that sold a lot of Enquirer magazines on the supermarket newsstands, covers featuring stories about Bill Clinton's womanizing and Hillary Clinton enabling him. So making the deal with Michael Cohen, something that he says happened in August 2015 with Cohen and then campaign communications director Hope Hicks in the room, was a win-win. The Enquirer would publish negative stories about Trump's opponents, which they did repeatedly, particularly when Ben Carson, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio started rising in the polls in the spring of 2016. And at the same time, running positive stories featuring Donald Trump as the ideal next president of the United States, which they also did throughout that year. Pecker was personally invited by Cohen to Trump's presidential announcement in Trump Tower. And he hoped to financially benefit from how many magazines the pro-Trump and anti-Trump competitor issues would sell. A total win-win. He also testified that once Trump announced his presidential bid, that he was in constant communication with Michael Cohen, as Pecker and a small group of AMI editors kept their eyes and ears peeled for stories that could be damaging to Trump so they could catch them and kill them before they were published anywhere else, at least before the election. And one by one, the prosecutor walked David Pecker through the deals that they cut with Dino Sagerden, the doorman who claimed to have information about a Trump love child with his Hispanic former housekeeper, which Pecker paid $30,000 for, despite his team vetting it and determining it was 1,000% untrue. Yet, they signed a deal with Mr. Sagerden that included a $1 million penalty for breaking it, which they let Sagerden out of in December 2016, after the election. The day ended on the deal AMI cut with Playboy model Karen McDougal, who got $150,000 after pitching a story of her own, a year-long affair with Trump, which she alleges and he denies. Today absolutely felt like a day to set up Cohen's own testimony and to make the point, which they did with exhibits on the big screens in the courtroom, that what Pecker is bringing to the table is not just stories about his favorite tabloid cover subject, but also physical receipts. And it's only just the beginning, as the prosecution hasn't even gotten to the Stormy Daniels part of the story yet. Joining me now is Neil Katyal, former acting solicitor general and MSNBC legal analyst. Katie Fang, trial attorney and host of The Katie Fang Show right here on MSNBC, who was at the courtroom with me today. And Brian Stelter, Vanity Fair special correspondent and author of the book of Network Lies. Thank you all for being here. Because you are at a disadvantage, our friend Neil, I'm going to go to you first. What were your impressions on today?
Well, first, I just want to say Katie's coverage of the trial live has been so spectacular.
Indeed.
And it's really criminal that the American public can't see it for themselves. And Katie's the next best thing. And I just have to really, my hat's off to her for translating all of the antics in the courtroom and everything. To me, the big headline is the loss of credibility that Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanch, had when he was trying to defend what Donald Trump was doing with his gag order. I mean, the gag order forbids Trump from commenting on jurors or prospective jurors. Trump clearly violated it. So what did his lawyer, Todd Blanch, do? Deny everything. And deny everything so much so that the judge said, you broken your reputation with me. Incredibility is the currency joy of a lawyer, as Katie knows. And a judge should only look at the facts and the law in a case, not a defendant's wealth or status. And the lawyer is the key part of persuasion in that. And of course, this is all foreign to Donald Trump, who's traded in power and status his whole life. But when his lawyer has lost credibility with the court, that's a very serious statement. It doesn't bode well for Trump's legal team. It bodes very poorly for Donald Trump, because lawyers are like nuclear weapons. If one side has a good one, then the other side has to get one.
Yeah, and there are a couple lawyers on the jury, too. And I want to co-sign what Neil said about you, Katie Fang. You are an exquisite attorney and also have been doing a fantastic job of translating this madness on air. You're doing a great job.
Thank
and
you.
We were buddies today in Team
Overflow.
Overflow. Tell me, because it was an interesting sort of you were telling me the names of everybody, making sure I knew who everybody was. And it was interesting when he seemed to do such a bad job that Todd Blanche actually got moved out of that first chair. But he was like really convening with Trump, and it wasn't really clear if Trump was happy with what he was doing. But what did you make of his performance?
Yeah, so to Neil's point, it is such a tragedy that the American public cannot see the dynamic that's going on inside there. But more specifically, a counsel's table for Donald Trump. Once you could see Donald Trump himself, the level of disinterest, the inattention, the perhaps sleeping that's going on. But things like this. He's not even looking at his lawyer when his lawyer's making arguments about him violating a gag order that could put him in jail. Wouldn't you have some interest if you may be looking at incarceration for up to 30 days? Mm. But to your point, Susan Nicholas, who's, according to everybody, people have known her for decades, she's a true criminal defense lawyer to this, in the sense of she really believes everybody deserves a defense. But she parks herself
all the way on the end.
The farthest way physically from Donald Trump. It's almost like she wants to be as far removed.
She was leaning away from him. Like she was at her body language. To lean far away.
And so for Todd Blanche to try to reestablish, Hugo talked about this just last hour, this kind of buddy-buddy kind of the energy with Donald Trump, I thought that was very telling because it was sheer humiliation.
Yeah.
I mean, Blanche had nothing left to say. And it's one thing to be, it's one thing for the judge to admonish you if you're in your zealousness to represent, that perhaps you argue a little too far. But what was humiliating truly? He had no evidence.
Yeah.
He had no defense.
No argument.
No arguments. And that is the problem when you're a lawyer. You're representing a client who's looking at 34 felonies and you have no evidence to refute it. And then you take a position that is the most absurd one, a repost.
Yeah.
It's not, it just happens. Like Judge Bershon said, oh, it just suddenly appeared. You saw it and suddenly appeared. And so I feel like when you, when this is your Alamo, like you want to die on this hill as a lawyer, it doesn't make any sense. But it, luckily, in some ways, it didn't happen in front of the jury. Because jurors sometimes can feel badly for lawyers. Sometimes they can
Pity was starting to set in. I mean, he really looked sad. He looked pathetic and fidgety and, like, uncomfortable. He didn't seem comfortable in his skin today
at all.
And
so jurors sometimes can be like, I feel kind of badly about this lawyer getting yelled at by the judge. And so in a good way, it didn't happen in front of the jury. And then the other good way is it does set a tone that Mershon's not taking it.
Yeah, he's not.
He's not having it.
And I like, Mershon really comes across as just this very genteel, like sort of kind professor who was just over it because you didn't do your homework. Brian, let's talk a little bit. I want to talk about David Pecker a little bit. I'm going to call on your media expertise. He did a thing that they don't even normally do in checkbook journalism, as he called it, buying really juicy stories and then not publishing them. And he even said in court, which I found kind of stunning, that with the Karen McDougal story, they were like, let's buy it, but we do want to use it just after the election. We do want to even use the story about the guy who claims there's an illegitimate son. They just didn't want to use it until after the election. Like, he seemed to really help that part of that case.
This idea of checkbook journalism, which people are hearing this phrase for the first time, it's a contradiction. There are no checkbooks in real journalism. We're not out there paying for stories in the real journalism world. But, you know, it's specifically because Donald Trump can't exist in a real journalism world. He doesn't want pesky fact checkers. He doesn't want people telling him that he's lying. He's created this alternative media universe, right? True Social is an example. But The Inquirer was the key example in 2015 and 2016. He created, he built up with his friend David Pecker, this alternative system to get out his news to his voters. And we're seeing it be dissected now in real time in this trial. This idea of friends of Pecker, FOPs, that you're a friend of Pecker. And so Trump gets a free ride. It is, has nothing to do with journalism. In fact, David Pecker, he's revealing himself not to be a journalist, not to be a newsman. He's an advertiser.
He's an advertiser.
He's a marketer, and his advertisement, his product was Donald Trump.
Well, he gave him something like, it's been estimated about $3 million a month of free advertising. I mean, he even created a magazine that was a quarterly magazine that's literally just about Donald Trump. I mean, he was talking about him in these weird reverential terms. And he seemed to say, look, he was asked, well, what can you do to help the campaign? And he's like, oh, I know what I can do. We're just going to find all these negative stories about
Trump.
We're
going to be your, quote, eyes and ears. He says it's Trump. I'm going to be your eyes and ears. And Michael Cohen was the go-between. So to your point, this is setting up the Cohen testimony.
And so then how is that a crime? Because that's what the prosecutor has to prove. Because catch and kill is unseemly. It's gross. But it's not illegal.
And that's why the New York statute that was previewed previously in the motions that were dealt with prior to this case actually surviving the motions to dismiss. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, this is important. Trials don't just materialize overnight. There was litigation. There was motion practice that happened that this indictment survived. Because a lot of people want to say there's nothing here. There's no there there. Donald Trump whipping out all like a toddler. Look at all of my friends saying there's no crime here. Well, Jonathan Turley is not the gold standard for that.
No.
So what happened is when you heard the testimony through Pecker that there was a conspiracy, mm-hmm. and the conspiracy existed with the defendant
right.
and Michael Cohen and now David Pecker, and you heard that the purpose of all of these catch and kill were to ensure that there was going to be nothing that was put out that was going to be negative or negatively impacting that campaign. That is a crime in New York.
Yeah.
It's not the non-disclosures, to your point. It's the actual trying to influence it, right? It's the, what are you trying to conceal?
Right.
What are you trying to hide? And that is exactly what you're trying to hide.
I will say this relationship was even cozier than I knew. I reported on the Inquirer almost 10 years ago. I've been reporting on these guys for years, but I'm learning new details.
Yeah.
You know, this is new information coming out in court about just how cozy.
And friendly,
it really was.
And I mean, Neil, not to put a too fine a point on it, but AMI made a non-prosecution deal in 2018 in which they explicitly admitted what they did was a crime. They admitted that they knew they were breaking campaign finance laws, that they knew that there was a limit on campaign contributions, and they exploded through it. So if he admitted to a crime and Michael Cohen was convicted of a crime, kind of hard to say that the only person who didn't commit a crime here is Trump.
That's exactly right, Joy. And like what the testimony today underscores is the same thing as that 2018 plea deal. Like AMI and the National Enquirer is where journalistic integrity goes to die, basically. Now, that's not always a crime.
Yeah.
If you're not running for president and like Trump was paying the National Enquirer perhaps to, you know, squelch stories about his girlfriend when he wasn't running or something, that's one thing. But if you're running for the presidency of the United States, you do so against a backdrop of a whole series of laws passed to ensure that the American voters have transparency in the process, and you can't get secret in-kind campaign contributions. I mean, imagine if Joe Biden had the Washington Post basically buying up all the stories about his son and Hunter Biden so that they could never be run and
right.
catching and killing them. Obviously, we would all be up in arms the same way as the New York District Attorney is here. And transparency really demands this prosecution. I don't think that the DA had a choice at this point when you've got someone who is spitting on our campaign finance laws.
You know, what that says to me, Brian, all of the reasons that Donald Trump was so much better off not running for president, because he could have kept doing a lot of the gross, unseemly things that he likes to do, and none of it would have necessarily run him up against the law.
That's so
because he could have done these catch and kills, but doing it for a campaign is where he messed up.
And David Pecker will be better off as well.
Everyone he knows
will be better off as well. David Pecker loved his life, this proximity to power, doing favors for his friends, punishing his enemies, putting nasty pictures of Hillary Clinton on the front of his magazine. He enjoyed the Inquirer. He's lost the Inquirer. He's now testifying against his longtime buddy. And you know how we know this is getting to Trump? The lies he's telling today about the crowds outside.
Yeah.
So you were on the inside. I was on the outside in the park today.
How big did they get?
I saw two or three Trump fans.
Yeah.
But tonight on Truth Social, Trump said thousands are being turned away from the armed camp in Lower Manhattan.
Oh, come on.
He's telling you not to believe your own eyes and ears. And I know we've seen that before. We saw that during COVID. But it's so telling that he's obsessed with this protester and lack of protester thing. And he's claiming that he has lots of fans who want to be there. They're just not being allowed into the park.
They can't get on the subways, buses, trains. They can't make it to Manhattan. I saw that empty park when we
walked in. Empty park. Beautiful day in Manhattan. People are out walking their dogs. You know, if you're
Brian,
in the city, come by.
But the bell ringer guy was there. And he was passionate.
That is true.
He was passionate.
He'll be back tomorrow on Thursday.
He'll be back.
More cowbell.
Brian Stelter, thank you very much. It's always
great to see you.
Neil and Katie are sticking around for much more on day two of testimony in Trump's hush money trial, including the judge's warning to Trump's lawyers that they are indeed losing credibility with the court. Stay right there.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Neil Katyal and Katie Fank are back with me. Let's talk more about kind of how things looked in the courtroom, Katie, because we were just talking about this offset. And Neil, I want to bring you in on this too. And because you're the one who said that you wish cameras were in the courtroom. With sitting in that courtroom, one of the things that really, struck me was how alone Donald Trump looked, sitting there with that backbench behind him empty and then the Secret Service in the one behind him, but no family there, no supporters there. He looked smaller. He looked less, like the sort of big, important man that he pretends to be. And it almost feels like the court system in some ways is protecting him from that image by allowing him to walk out to cameras and project whatever image he wants to project. Katie, you first and then Neil.
I struggle because I think in a blanket way, you need to have cameras. I think sunshine is the best disinfectant, as we know. And transparency is what the American public always deserves because you need to be able to see the hypocrisy that's going on. For example, when they showed the negative headlines about Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio that the National Enquirer did to benefit the Trump campaign, and I want to ring that bell over and over again. The hypocrisy is it's bad for Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, according to the fake news headlines in The Enquirer, to have mistresses and to have porn stars and to have all of this illicit stuff happen. But it's okay for Donald Trump, right? It's like a badge of honor for him. You want to be able to be offended as well when you see that exhibit and then you look at him and you think, you know what? No, you don't get to get away with that, too.
Yeah.
America doesn't get to see that. And then what happens is Donald Trump goes to Truth Social.
Yeah.
Unfettered and says lies. He actually promotes lies and tells lies. And so whether you like him or not, you should be able to see him in his natural habitat.
Yeah.
And the natural habitat of him is small, shriveled, old, tired.
Yeah.
Not sympathetic.
Yeah.
But just alone.
Yeah. And, and Neil, also to hear the judge, because this is, it's very instructive to actually see the court case take place and to hear the judge go back and forth with Donald Trump's lawyer about this gag order, the thing that you pointed out, because you're seeing a lawyer kind of shrink before your eyes because he had no arguments. But no one got to see it but those of us who were sitting there.
Yeah, I agree, Joy. I mean, these courtrooms are the American public's courtrooms. We pay for them with our taxpayer dollars. And the idea that like this is all going on in a closed proceeding that, fortunately, we're lucky that we have people like Katie there who can interlocute and translate what's going on for us. But there's no substitute for seeing it with our own eyes, particularly when the country is as divided as it is about all of these issues surrounding Donald Trump. And I think both sides would benefit from the earring and public transparency that would otherwise occur. I remember when I was special prosecutor in the George Floyd murder, we had initially opposed cameras and televising that trial. And I'll tell you, Joy, we were wrong. And the judge ruled against us, and he was right, even though there had never been a trial in Minnesota that had been televised up until that point. But what that did was allow the American public confidence around the verdict, so much so that, we didn't have the riots and all the other stuff that people were predicting because people could see the trial with their own eyes. As for what's going on today with Donald Trump being alone in the courtroom, I think that's at least in part a product of his criminal behavior. I mean, the people who would have ordinarily been there, Michael Cohen, Alan Weisselberg, They're, you know, they've been indicted or put in jail or now testifying against them. David Pecker's another one. So, you know, everything Trump touches, it's kind of the anti-Midas touch.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that play out in real time in the courtroom. And I really do wish the American public could see it.
I agree.
It's wrong.
It was really instructive to be there. I mean, and Katie, speaking of Michael Cohen,
sure.
He's been on this show, you know, dozens of times. He's been on this show a lot. And one thing that struck me, he's told me, he's told this audience, he's told MSNBC's audience the same story for years.
Yep.
And now everything he said, you have David Pecker today backing him up to a point. I mean, literally, he's been telling this story consistently. And so now what's happened is he's already been backed up by David Pecker, who was the other person in the room making this deal, who said, yeah, we did do a catch and kill deal. Yeah, it was about the election. Michael Cohen had a campaign email, even though he was not on the campaign. There was no reason for him to a campaign email. And David Pecker said, you can release these salacious stories that would have sold lots of magazines, but only after the election.
And one of the most amazing things is we have now been introduced to the conspiracy so early in the prosecution's case. Sometimes there's a wind up to the pitch, and sometimes you wait through a couple of witnesses before you kind of get to the meat on the bone of the conspiracy and of the crime. And yet David Pecker, within just a few hours,
yeah,
not even, has explained with such clarity, even for a guy who's been around for a long time, the longtime friend for decades, David Pecker even still showed respect to Donald Trump today.
Respect. He seemed reverential toward him.
Exactly. And so to hear it come from someone who very matter-of-factly said, David Pecker says, yeah, we sat there in Trump Tower and we agreed to do the following. And yes, Alan Weisselberg was a part of it. And it's just so matter of fact. It's just so, you know, in a way that lends credibility. And that is the critical thing. Neil and I and others that have tried cases, a witness's credibility is always going to be squarely in the province of the jury. The judge doesn't determine the witness's credibility.
Right.
And so for the jury to be hearing total and complete corroboration from David Pecker, and as well as seeing, because
and
we're
seeing
visual creatures. When you see the exhibits and you see the amendment to Dino Sajudin's source document to silence him, and then you see, what do you mean it's going to be extended to perpetuity where you're not going to be able to air it for a while? Oh, and then suddenly we're going to let you out of it?
Yeah.
That type of stuff is powerful.
And charge him $1 million if he takes that story anywhere else, only to poof, make it go away in December of 2016 after the election. Things that make you go, Neil Katyal, Katie Fang, y'all are great. Thank you very much. And up next, newly unsealed documents reveal that Trump, the aforementioned Trump, was told by his own associate to turn over everything he took from the White House or he'd risk indictment. But he's Donald Trump, so clearly he didn't listen. That's next.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
You can live out your MasterChef dreams when you find a professional on Angie to tackle your dream kitchen remodel. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.
Yesterday in Florida, Trump-friendly Judge Aileen Cannon released 400 pages of unsealed documents that shed new light on how the Department of Justice built its rock-solid case against Trump for stealing classified documents. Within those 400 pages is a stunning FBI interview from a high-ranking Trump World official who was so afraid of reprisal that they requested that interview not be recorded. What we also learn is that pretty much everyone in Trump's world knew that he had taken classified documents and that he should just hand them over and hand them all back. All 50 boxes that this official believed Trump had taken with him. In late 2021, this official told the former president, "Whatever you have, give it all back." The response was, "We'll check and think about it." When that didn't happen, Trump allies turned to his children to get him to do the right thing. "There are issues with the boxes. They belong to the government. Talk to your dad about giving them back. It's not worth the aggravation." This same official flew to Florida, drove to Mar-a-Lago, and impressed upon Trump who was dressed in his golf khakis and entertaining a young female fan, that whatever you have, give everything back. Let them come here and get everything. Don't give them a noble reason to indict you, because they will. Joining me now is Nick Ackerman, former Watergate assistant special prosecutor and former assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. Nick, some people just can't learn. They have to feel.
No, but this is typical Donald Trump. There is nothing new here. The fact that he was telling Walt Nano that he would pardon him, even if he lied to the FBI, don't worry about it. Hang tight. I'm going to pardon you. We've seen that story before. We saw it with Roger Stone, who the judge in that case, when he was convicted, found that he was covering up for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, what happens? He gets pardoned by Donald Trump. You've got Paul Manafort, who was supposedly going to cooperate until Donald Trump started dangling a pardon in front of him.
Yeah.
Paul Manafort could have broken open this entire Russian investigation. He knew where the bodies were buried, who knew about the Russian agent that he was dealing with and providing detailed information to about various parts of the battleground states in order to micro-target voters.
Mm-hmm.
And he wound up clamming up.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, he was pardoned.
Yeah.
So when Walt Nato listens to Donald Trump, he sees a history of an individual that's covered a few people's backs. And this is all part of Donald Trump's pattern that he's been conducting since he got into office.
There's something about all of this that feels very mafioso.
It's very mafioso.
Yeah.
It definitely is. It's like you have to pledge an allegiance to the tutti capo de tutti capo.
Yeah.
And everything is it's an idea. It's like the feudal system of providing benefits to the feudal people out there, the serfs.
Yeah.
So that they do the work for you. They'll take care of destroying tapes so that the government doesn't get evidence of people moving boxes in and out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like he is the guy in charge and what he says goes. And you've got two people that are now defendants in this case with him in Florida that it really explains why they haven't cooperated.
I have a question, because it's very clear that the judge in this case wants the case to go away, that she's, I don't know what he promised her other than maybe a Supreme Court seat, but, she's not letting the case go forward. Could the case against Walt Nauta and the other Fall Guys go forward without Trump?
Oh, it could, but that doesn't make any sense, because in a way, these two people really are kind of the albatross around Trump's neck. I mean, they're the ones that did all of the
dirty work. But I mean, we've seen that in the Michael Cohen situation. Michael Cohen did the dirty work. He didn't sleep with Stormy Daniels. He's the one who took out the loan, took a risk of his own self and getting mortgage fraud convictions and lied to Congress for Trump. Everything he did for Trump. He was the Fall Guy. He did go to prison. So in this case, is there some chance that Walt Nauta and the other Fall Guys in this case will go to prison and let Trump skate?
They may go to prison, but I don't think Trump is going to skate. I
mean, if the case ever goes to trial.
If it goes to trial, that's right. And I think the government is in a weird position right now, because right now they know that the judge has backed off those crazy jury instructions that she asked them to do, which is really the most bizarre thing I've ever seen. And they're kind of betwixt and between as to whether or not to take her up on appeal.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question about today's Michael Cohen hearing. We were talking during the break about you were saying there are things in that transcript that people have not really highlighted. Tell me one of those things.
Well,
the transcript of the New York.
Everybody now has access to these transcripts. They all went up
This is in the New York Hush Money election interference case.
That's right.
Yeah.
So they're all up there.
Yeah.
And you go through these things. There's one little piece of evidence that just hit me between the eyes. And that's the tape recording that Michael Cohen made of Donald Trump talking about Karen McDougal and the setup to pay her and to buy back from Pecker, from the National Enquirer, the rights that they got from Karen McDougal.
Right.
And I always wondered, why the heck did Michael Cohen ever make that tape recording of Donald Trump and not tell him about it?
Yeah.
What we know now, if you look at the opening of the DA's opening in there, it's because Michael Cohen wanted to use that tape to convince Pecker that Donald Trump was actually interested in paying that $150,000 to take back the rights to Karen McDougal's story.
Right.
So Michael Cohen was not telling his boss what he was doing, but yet he was playing the tape for Pecker.
Right.
And so what you've got is, you've got Pecker who's going to identify the tape at trial.
Yeah.
You've got Michael Cohen who's going to identify the tape. And the tape is none other than Donald Trump, who's right in the middle.
Yeah.
So if there's ever a question about credibility here,
and
that blows their argument about credibility
out
of the water.
Nick Ackerman, such a valuable friend to have for the show. Thank you very much, my friend.
Thank
you. Much appreciated. Coming up next, hundreds of students and now some college professors have been arrested as pro-Palestinian protests have only grown on college campuses throughout the country, despite pressure from members of Congress and people in the media. We will talk to a Jewish professor at Columbia University who participated in yesterday's protest. We'll be right back. The Israel-Hamas war continues to fuel a national debate over free speech and student demonstrations amid growing unrest over the fate of Palestinians in Gaza. Dozens of universities across the country are seeing pro-Palestinian encampments pop up in the wake of New York's Columbia University sicking the police on the encampment there. Today, 9 University of Minnesota students were arrested for setting up tents, as were several Yale students. At New York University, a demonstration Monday night turned chaotic, with the university calling the police to assist with dispersing the growing crowd. More than 100 people were taken into custody, including students and professors. And today, more than 100 pro-Palestinian protesters gathered in Washington Square Park to show solidarity with students and faculty who were arrested. Columbia University says classes will now be hybrid until the end of the spring semester after 100 of its students were arrested last week. Joining me now is Marianne Hirsch, professor of English and Cooperative Literature at Columbia University and professor emerita in the Institute for Research on Women, Gender, and Sexuality. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
What's so strange about what's happening at your university at Columbia is that the peaceful protesters got the cops sicked on them, while the mad people who were outside of campus screaming at Jewish people, screaming epithets and becoming violent, and who some people think might be plants, they're not getting the cops sicked on them. Why?
Well, the university only organizes its own space, and what happened was that the gates were opened and cops were invited into the university to disrupt the peaceful protest by students. Now, what happens outside the gates is New York City.
But it sounds to me like what's happening on these university campuses is that students have fewer free speech rights than whoever wants to show up outside. And there is this attempt to kind of bully college students that you're thinking wrong about what's happening in Gaza. And we're just going to punish you until you stop thinking that way.
It's a weaponization of anti-Semitism under the guise of security and safety for students who say they're feeling uncomfortable. And it rests on a profound misunderstanding of what anti-Semitism actually is. It's very painful for somebody who's Jewish and
yes.
has studied anti-Semitism
yeah.
during her career. I think the impression is that if you just any pro-Palestinian, any Palestinian narrative is a threat to the Israeli state.
Yeah.
That any kind of criticism of the state of Israel's actions, violent actions in Gaza, is anti-Semitic. It's not anti-Semitic. It's criticizing a state. It's not criticizing an identity
right.
or a faith.
And this is the thing, is that in theory, if Israel is a secular state and is a state with multiple religions inside it, there are Christian people living there, there are Jewish people living there, there are Muslim people living there, then criticizing that country and its policies, how that has become translated, even for some of the media here, as it's inherently anti-Semitic. You must approve the way Israel is conducting the war in Gaza. You must approve every single killing. It must be approved or you're anti-Semitic. It doesn't make sense to me.
It feels like a threat to Jews as Jews, whereas it's actually a criticism of the actions of a state.
Of a country. Of a
country.
So how do we translate? I mean, you have this metastasizing movement. Many of the people marching are Jewish themselves, young people who
yes.
are Jewish. Even their organizations are being told they're anti-Semitic.
Well, they've been suspended at Columbia. A Jewish Voice for Peace
yeah.
is a student organization of Jews. Many, many Jewish students are in the encampment at Columbia. Last night, I was very honored to be invited as a faculty member to a Seder that was held within the pro-Palestinian encampment. It was just a beautiful ceremony of Jewish students with lots of other students included. Yeah. We chanted in Hebrew and Yiddish. Nobody was attacking us. We all felt safe.
Why do you suppose that the leadership at Columbia and these other schools are capitulating so dramatically in advance to people like Elise Stefanik, who are being performative? She wants to demonstrate that how much she loves Trump and the right, and are capitulating to certain donors who don't like the general liberal vibe at places like Columbia, and they want to shift it to the right by bullying students. Why are they capitulating to that?
It's a plot to undermine universities, to humiliate university presidents and what, you know, the elite. I think there's a lot of there's a lot at stake. There's funding at stake.
Sure.
If these universities lose federal funding, that would be a complete disaster. I think there's a lot of intimidation and bullying by Congress, by the Congressional Committee.
Yeah.
But we have other representatives as well, and I'm afraid that, you know, our mayor called these protests anti-Semitic. President Biden called these protests anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
So they're all resting on the same kind of misunderstanding of what anti-Semitism is. And I think they want to protect Jews, but, I mean, not everybody does. I don't think that Congressional Committee and Stefanik are at all about, you know, protecting Jewish students. They want to score points. They want to score MAGA points.
What do you think that President Biden and the mayor and the governor, because you're right, they're jumping on the bandwagon, some Democratic members of Congress, to essentially write off the, you know, the hundreds of thousands of young people who simply are against a war that they find distasteful because children are dying. How can that be wrong? But you even have Democrats jumping on this bandwagon.
They find it unbearable, but there's a movement that there are, you know, well-funded campaigns to convince the Democrats as well as Republicans.
Absolutely.
That this is anti-Semitic, that being anti-Israeli state actions is anti-Semitic and is hurting members of the Jewish community in this country. Now, you know, there's a long history of anti-Semitism. Jews have suffered anti-Semitism for 5,000 years. This is true. There are anti-Semitic acts in this country. But there's also all kinds of other bias and racialized persecution.
Absolutely.
That right now our universities are not doing very much to protect Muslim students and Palestinian students.
Indeed.
From attacks on them.
I appreciate you. Marianne Hirsch, thank you. I want to take your class. It's been wonderful meeting you. Thank you so much. Before we go to a break, I want to remind you, 4 years ago today, this happened.
And then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute. 1 minute, and is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number in the lungs, so it'd be interesting to check that.
You're definitely better off 4 years later if you didn't inject the bleach. Ah, memories. Up next, the Trump-Biden split screen. Stay right there.
They're keeping me in a courtroom, that's freezing, by the way, in a courtroom all day long while he's out campaigning. He's out campaigning, and I'm here in a courtroom, sitting up as straight as I can all day long.
We got a telling split screen today marking this year's election. Trump in court, Biden on the campaign trail. The president is in Florida giving his first major speech on abortion since Trump suggested the issue be left to the states. And he's forcefully calling out Trump's role as the main architect of this post-Roe America.
Trump bragged how proud he was to get rid of Roe v. Wade over. He took credit for it. He said there has to be punishment for women exercising their reproductive freedom. His words, not mine. He described the Dobbs decision as a miracle. Maybe it's coming from that Bible he's trying to sell. Whoa. I almost wanted to buy one just to see what the hell's in it.
Biden's visit comes as Florida joins Arizona as an epicenter of the battle over abortion restrictions. Florida's six-week abortion ban is poised to go into effect 1 week from tomorrow. And Florida voters are gearing up for a November ballot measure that would enshrine abortion rights in its constitution. If you take a step back and look at these maps, you will note a striking similarity between states Trump carried in 2020 and states where abortion is banned and or unavailable. But poll after poll and election after election since the Roe decision has shown that regardless of how the states voted in the past, abortion is a losing issue for Trump. NBC's latest poll finds Biden leading by a 15-point margin on which candidate would be better on this issue, which, surprise, surprise, also happens to be a top issue on voters' minds. So as the former president is stuck in court, spending more and more of his donors' money on legal fees, it's worth noting just how much abortion is raising the stakes for the November election and creating the potential to flip the electoral map. And it's not just Florida that's in play here. And that's tonight's readout.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.